order for Thursday, March 2nd, 2017, the meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. We all see before us once again Dr. Salon Noir, also David Mandel from the Early Learning Division, and we are going to continue about where we stopped yesterday on their presentation, and I believe I need to open that, those hearings also. So I'd like to call to order open hearing on Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 5517.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. Thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you today and to continue to present the Oregon Department of Education's budget. I want to draw your attention before I turn it over to David to continue his presentation on the Early Learning Division to the document that we provided to Doug Wilson yesterday. Regarding the questions that you posed to us in the course of the presentation. Yes,
and, you want
to
and say those are, that, yeah. Just so you know, we'll try to post the responses to questions. Those specific ones should be on yesterday's. We'll try to post them on the day that they were asked or as close as possible. So they're on posted on yesterday's poll list.
And the overall presentation is on the 27th, is that correct?
So I believe we provided you the information that you requested. Representative Parrish asked questions about the funding sources that schools can access to support education. Senator Monroe asked a question about the demographics of students, of the early learning students, children ages 0 to 5. We provided that information. Yeah. Representative Wisnant asked a question about school safety in addition to state agency building safety, and we provided you a plan that was supported by the legislature to do that, and there is currently a bill regarding threat assessment that's being pursued through the Senate. And also, Representative Wisnant asked a question about the Every Student Succeeds Act, and we intend to provide you information in the course of our presentation that gets into the specific programs of that law and the agency's plan, but we also provided you a summary document and the draft plan that's currently posted on our website for feedback and input from the field. And we would welcome input from you if you would like to take the time to review it. We would love to get some input and some direct feedback from you as well. So with that, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I'll turn it over to David Mandel to continue his presentation.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director. Before I continue with my presentation, I would just like to address Senator Monroe's question on the language diversity of children under 5 in the state. And it's actually also an interesting opportunity one of the interesting features of the early learning world compared to K through 12 is children are not actually enrolled in one place. So it's the data challenges are really different, which is actually why the kindergarten assessment has been so important as getting a little bit of a snapshot. So if you look at the kindergarten assessment, 17% of the kids entering kindergarten are identified as English language learners. I thought it was also useful to give to give a sort of snapshot of the children that we work directly with. If you look at Oregon pre-kindergarten Head Start, about 32% of those children have a home language identified as other than English. 25% identify a home language as Spanish. So I think that just gives you a little bit of a window into that.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
It's going to be interesting to see in 2 or 3 years the impact of everybody having full-day kindergarten. That's something that I am very much looking forward to seeing because I know it's going to be dramatic.
And with that, let me launch into the Early Learning Division's budget.
And can I ask one quick question to clarify that? So when you talked about the 35% of student of the Head Start that spoke a language other than English at home, 25% of that is Spanish?
No, 25% of the entire. Sorry, I was,
great.
My apologies for that confusion. So 25% of all children in OPK Head Start, their parents identified that their home language is Spanish.
Okay.
And of that entire population, 35%.
Great.
Yes.
Thank you.
So with that, let me move on to just an overview of the Early Learning Division's budget. The Early Learning Division's total legislatively approved budget for 2015-17 was about $400 million. 58% of that, $230 million, is general fund. And most of that, as you'll see, is grant and aid that goes directly out to programs and communities to pay for services. I think it's also just worth mentioning off the top that about a quarter of our budget, close to about $100 million, is actually transferred to Department of Human Services for employment-related daycare. About 39% of that is federal funds, the vast majority of which is from the Child Care Development Fund, the federal block grant for child care subsidies and to support the child care system. For 2015-2017 legislative approved budget, our federal funds also included about $12 million of Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Fund dollars that paid for a lot of our system building work over the last 4 years. That grant ended in December of last year. We have a no-cost extension that allows us to finish up some of that work, but the Race to the Top funds will be largely disappearing this upcoming budget cycle.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Head Start, there's money that the state pays. Most of it comes federal government. Is that in the Department of Ed's budget?
No, this is really interesting, and I will actually talk about this okay. some more. Head Start is a federal to local grantee.
Oh,
so okay. The funds, we actually have no relationship to okay. the federal funds. But when I talk about OPK, you'll see that becomes a much more complicated story.
Okay, just wanted to.
but that's a good point. Those are important investments in early learning that are not part of the state budget. Finally, we have about $13.5 million in other funds. Much of this is also federal funds that other agencies receive and then transfer to us. This includes some Medicaid match that goes to Healthy Families Oregon, some Social Security block Title 20 dollars that go to relief nurseries, and Title 4 2B family support dollars that DHS sends to us that we contract out with programs, including our early learning hubs. There's also a little bit of child care contribution tax credit funds that go to support child care providers. And finally, there's a small amount of licensing fees that the Office of Child Care collects that are part of that. This slide gives you a sense of how that budget translates into programs. As you can see, almost all of our general fund budget goes straight to programs, with Oregon pre-kindergarten being the largest share of the state's investment in early learning. The work of the Office of Child Care, which I'll discuss in greater detail, is mostly federally funded. And you'll be hearing a lot about CCDF from me today, because it really is a significant driver of all the work that we do. So what I was sharing with you before was the legislatively approved budget for 2015-17. This is the current service level budget for 2017-19. You'll see a total increase to about $415 million. As Rick Kreger mentioned in his presentation, a lot of that increase is the rollout from Preschool Promise, since that was only 1 year of the last biennium, and that'll be 2 years of this biennium. You'll also see a little bit of shrinkage in the federal funds, reflecting the closeout of the Race to the Top grant. So this gives you a sense of our grants versus operations. As I mentioned earlier, most of our budget goes directly out into the field to serve children and families through the various early learning programs that we administer, but also some of the child care subsidy programs. 7%, about $30 million, is our operations budget. And that operations budget, as you'll also see more later on, is also a largest chunk of that's federally funded.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Mandel, on this pie chart and the ones before, we have a lot of grant and federal money. You've talked about some of that's going to go away. How much maintenance of effort and matching funds is the state providing to that. And if you don't have that, we can bring that back to us. But what I'm looking at here is, I mean, this budget is it's grown tremendously from eight. You know, it's you know, we're talking $400 million. That's a tremendous increase in when I was on the Commission for Children and Families of money. So I'll try to spend more time or talk to Mr. Wilson, but you know, you're saying a lot's passing through. Your operations is low 7%, but if all you're doing is passing, because we're going to get to your organizational chart in a minute, and I'll need some clarification on that as far as your 88 people in one office or something. But so back to my question, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, is a lot of this, is some of this maintenance of effort, so we're going to pick that up if federal money goes away, and how much is do we have to buy match for some of these federal funds?
Chair Smith-Warner, Chairman Rowe, Representative Wisnett, sort of two parts to the federal match question. There is a federal match in maintenance of effort associated with the Child Care Development Fund. That's something that we've historically had no problem addressing, and that is not a cost driver, that match piece. There are some really complicated cost drivers associated with the Child Care Development Fund that I will get to. The Race to the Top funds did not have a match associated with it. There are some, and most of those funds, and I'll talk a little bit about this in more detail when I get to the governor's requested budget and some of these other pieces. Most of that funds was really for building infrastructure and supports. There are some pieces that we would like to be able to sustain that I'll talk about as part of the governor's requested budget, but that's not a driver of the CSL.
I'll wait. I'll do it offline or whatever. Thank you.
Senator Thompson?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair. I just have a question. I would like to, besides kindergarten students, how many students are we affecting, or how many students are in the early learning don't count kindergarten, because that's kind of in the school system anyway. And then does that overlap with what Head Start's doing? Are we serving a lot of the same kids, or is Head Start program doing what they're doing? So I just kind of like to get a number of how many kids we're affecting out there with these dollars.
Right, and this becomes a little, co-chairs, Smith-Warner and Monroe, Representative Thompson. This becomes a little bit of a complicated question, because there's really a couple different functions that the Early Learning Division plays. So there's about 230 children who are not yet of school age. There's about
230,000.
About 19,000 that we directly affect through the programs that we administer. But there's also an additional over 100,000 children that we're impacting through our regulatory function. And then, you know, about a quarter of our budget is also transferred to DHS for employment-related daycare. With probably another 13,000 families impacted through that. So that's a little bit obscured in this circle. I'm hoping there'll be a little bit more clarity on that as we sort of walk through the rest of the budget and the different functions that the Early Learning Division plays. But I think because of that both program role and regulatory function, there's different answers to the population that we serve and different ways that we serve them.
Thank you. And also, Senator, if you look at page 48 is a handy shorthand as well. That was right at the end yesterday. So, sorry, go ahead.
Let me follow that up.
Sure.
230,000, is that how many kids there are in the state?
Yes.
That's not how many kids are in the program.
Correct.
So my question was, how many kids are we serving in the program? I don't think it said that.
It actually does on page 48 of their thing. That's laid out. Rep. Hernandez?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a quick question. For the grants that are given out, and this is a little tangent, but for the grants that are given out, how do folks in the community recognize that this is state-funded programming, or do they at all?
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Hernandez. The answer to that question really differs program by program, so that's something I'll touch on a little bit as I go through the different programs. But what your question does get at is there are really a wide variety of community partners that we work with and fund, from community-based organizations to our early learning hubs to sometimes we have public health as a partner through our home visiting program. So it's really a diversity of answers, and the answer also varies by program. But also, I think, to get a part of your question, I think there may be times where children and families are receiving services and don't really know that it's publicly funded. I'm not sure that's necessarily, I think our concern is more that children and families get what they need than that we always get the credit for it.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, Senator part Monroe. Of Senator Thompson's question was whether there was overlap between the federally funded Head Start and state programs, whether you're dealing with the same kids or those are different kids that we're serving. We serve some with state dollars, some are served through Head Start with federal dollars, and I believe they're not the same kids.
Co-Chair Monroe and Smith Warner, committee members, yes, I'll should be talking a lot about how our Head Start OPK program works, and given the nature of the collaboration, there is no overlap. Right. There are not kids who are enrolled in both. Many of the programs receive funding from both streams, and at the classroom level, you couldn't necessarily say that this is a Head Start child versus a state-funded child. But the state funding is set up in a way it ensures that we're serving additional children, not overlapping.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Real quick.
Senator Rowland?
And there are some kids that are served in both because our special needs kids and early identifying kids, there's federal money, there's state money, and sometimes they're housed in some of these programs. So they're providing the service that both of us are paying for.
At risk kids,
some of those kids, the developmentally delayed kids and others.
Co-chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, that's correct, particularly for early intervention, earlier childhood special ed, which is actually not a program that we administer, but we do work really closely with, because that's really a program that's focused on children with special needs, and that there's a real emphasis on supporting children either at home or in natural settings. There's often a collaborative relationship where, for instance, a child may be enrolled in Head Start, and there's additional services particular to that special need that are applied in that setting.
And that also has Department of Ed, right? You're
yes.
part of that.
That is correct, yes.
Go ahead.
So I'd like to walk you a little bit through our federal funds. As you can see, most of our federal funds are from the Child Care Development Block Grant. I'll be using the term Child Care Development Fund and CCDF interchangeably for that. As part of our no-cost extension, there's a little bit of Race to the Top funding in the 2017-19 budget. That's to continue a couple projects that funded. Along with every other state, we receive a small federal grant to support really the position of a Head Start collaboration director. And this is actually part of the federal effort, given that that is a federal to local program, to make sure there's also resources to integrate that in state. Because of our particular relationship with federal Head Start, it's probably less of a challenge in this state than in other states. So this chart gives you a little bit of a projected breakdown of the Child Care Development Fund for 2017-19. Most of the CCDF goes to pay for child care subsidies for low-income working families. Of the approximately $140 million that we anticipate receiving, and I'll put the the emphasis on and anticipate. Over the next biennium, close to $107 million will be for direct subsidies to low-income working families. There's a few special population subsidy programs that we run directly, but most of that, again, is that transfer to Department of Human Services for employment-related daycare. 14% of these funds go to support the licensing and regulation of child care. This includes the processing of child care licensing, particularly the background checks for the central background registry, on-site health and safety monitoring of programs as part of licensure, and the follow-up on complaints and compliance issues. There's also a number of quality support and professional development programs that are part of that are also funded through the Child Care Development Fund. I mean, I think the simple answer is, without the Child Care Development Fund, there would be no child care system in the state.
And these are general funds?
This is federal funds.
This is federal.
This
okay,
is federal
thank you.
Funds.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yes. And I'm going to keep on coming back to that.
There
because
we go. The Child Care Development
you'll,
Fund.
You'll
yeah.
really see that's yeah. this is really the major source of funding for our operations. And, you know, a good percentage of that $400 million budget. This is just another look at current service level for 2017-19 by program. Again, it looks much like the legislatively approved budget with some growth for inflation. The biggest change is in preschool promise, which goes from $17.5 million to $35.1 million. And again, this change reflects the fact that preschool promise was rolled out really in the September of this year. So that $17.5 million was paying for services for 1 year. So current service level is extending that for 2 years.
Representative Parrish?
On the last slide with the federal funds, do you have a projection for what you would have to change if those federal funds did not arrive in the manner that you are currently projecting them to be here? What changes in your agency and what changes in the delivery of services and how do you prioritize that?
Co-Chair Smith and Warner, Monroe, Representative Parrish, we don't have quite a projection on that right now. I'm going to spend some time talking about one of the things that's also happening is the feds have added a lot of new work along with CCDF in the last 2 years. And so that's in part what we've actually been really focusing on are meeting those new federal requirements that go along with the funding. And I will touch on that later on in the presentation. As with every federal fund, there's a fair amount of prescription that goes along with it. And I'll be able to touch on that, and I think that will help answer your question, but also make it more complicated.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Wisner?
Oh, I'm ahead of myself. Next slide.
Okay.
Or the next, not this one, the next. Okay, this one here.
Okay.
Director, are you going to talk more about relief nurseries in your presentation?
I will.
I'll wait then. Thank you.
So now I'd like to go a little bit over our operations budget and also what that means in terms of staffing for the division. As I noted earlier, our operations budget's $30.6 million and we have a total of FTE of about 107. If you take a look at our operations, you'll see the division is really divided into four teams, leadership management, two FTEs, program team with about 14 FTEs that's responsible for the administration and quality improvement efforts and supports for the programs that we directly administer, like OPK, Relief Nurseries, Healthy Families, Oregon, Preschool Promise. And then we have a policy and partnership team that oversees policy development, legislative relations, and is also responsible for overseeing and administering our system of early learning hubs. And then finally, by far the largest part of our organization, the Office of Child Care, with 88 out of the 107 FTEs. About 45 of those 88 are located in communities across the state. The Office of Child Care has 8 field offices that include Milton Friedwater, Medford, Eugene, Redmond, and the Dalles. These are the folks who are responsible for making both unannounced and announced visits to licensed child care facilities every year to make sure that health and safety regulations are met, and for following up when there are concerns that need to be addressed. So it's
if I could clarify, so of those, so there's 8 field offices, there are 88, it's 88.5 FTE in this office. How many of those are in the 8 field offices? Not one by one, but overall.
45.
45 of them are in those, okay.
Right. And then a significant other portion of that are in our central office that has a couple of main responsibilities. So complaints and compliance issues go through the central office. And then, but also one of the other main responsibilities of the central office is processing child care licenses and enrollment in the central background registry. So that's a centralized registry that allows, so one of the state requirements for working in a licensed child care facility is to have passed a background check that looks both at some criminal history and involvement with child protective services. We maintain a central background registry that allows you, if you move from one facility to another, you don't have to go back through the background check. That also applies to other adults who may be in a family child care home and have access to children. So that central office is responsible for processing 28,000 central background registry enrollments per year. And again, this is something that I'm going to be coming back to later on in the presentation.
Okay. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, are we going to come back to this one in more detail?
Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Representative Wisnett, somewhat, but if you have questions on it, this may be a good time to ask.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please.
Thank you. This is a real important part of the need of Oregonians, low income and poverty. You talked about, it's called Projected Child Care and Development Fund. In Deschutes County, we don't have enough daycare. I've worked on that issue for years. We want quality daycare, but we don't even have daycare. And a lot of people have tried it. We've tried it nonprofit. We've tried it businesses. Businesses are afraid because of the suits. They don't want to do it in-house. Some do. Nike, I think, are some of the biggest corporations. But out in Eastern Oregon, it's very difficult. You don't, in your division here, who is trying to look at that problem, gaining more daycare? I don't know if the other legislators have had this problem, but I've been called weekends and everything by daycares and say, hey, they're going to close me down because my oven doesn't vent properly. And so, or I had a person come in sick, so I don't have the ratio. So I have to tell all these parents, you can't go to work because I can't open the doors to my daycare. So I understand safety. I mean, I don't want anyone there, but it's a real problem. And I'd like to have data on how the state's doing as far as increasing the number of daycare facilities, nonprofit or profit or whatever, and that should be a goal because you can't go to work, you can't go to the doctor if you don't have daycare. So, especially for our most needy population. So, can the director comment? Are you looking at this? Are you working on this? And I think your enforcement people, like I said, I didn't have success. I was very disappointed in the responses and help I got on waving the ventilation fan for the stove, which is only used to warm meals. So can you comment on that, Director, please?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe, Representative Wisnett.
Just a little question.
I really appreciate that question, and there's really two questions there, neither of which have a simple answer. I mean, the supply of child care is a huge problem. It is crucial for allowing parents to work. We know those experiences are also crucial for the trajectory that children have in their development. The truth of the matter is, when you look at the child care market, we know that two things are simultaneously true, that the early learning workforce is paid, for the most part, close to poverty wages,
yep.
and parents can't afford the cost of child care. Both of those things are true at the same time, and to be honest, I think the fact of those two things being simultaneously true is part of the driver of why access to child care is limited. I think that's also part of the answer of why the system of child care subsidies is so important, and the work that we do to support the early learning workforce and to try to keep them in the field is also true. It is something that we really do care about, but I also don't think it's one of those questions where there's an easy answer. I do think some of the increases in publicly funded early learning opportunities helps with it, but certainly does not provide the full answer to it. To your second question, which I think is also, I'll say, is a really difficult question, is that we really want to support child care programs. We want them to stay in business. We want them to succeed. We want them to have the resources to not only be professionally successful, but to provide the best care to children. We also have a responsibility around health and safety. That's a challenging balancing act, and I'm sure in particular instances we'd probably disagree on whether we got that balancing act correct.
Follow up, Les. So if you could provide us, though, the data of the committee of how we're doing. I mean, is it regional? We've got zero, or we're growing there, we're not growing there, and any plans that you have to improve that would be helpful. Thank you.
Perhaps a map that shows kind of how many childcare, because that's clearly we license them. So if you could do that, give us a visual representation and or maybe both that and a list of county by county, would that be helpful?
Representative Wisnett? Yeah. And again, are we losing them? Are they growing? And why is that happening? What can we do as a legislature, as an agency, state agency, to help those people stay in business, I guess.
Representative Smith-Warner, Senator Monroe, Representative Wisnett. This becomes we have some of that information. So one of the things that we look at is the visible child care spaces, in a ratio to population as a way of looking at that, and we can provide that data. It becomes a little bit complicated, and it's something I'll also touch on in a little bit. There is also a lot of child care that we don't license. So if you're providing care for fewer than three children, you're license exempt. If you are license exempt, unless you are working with a family that's receiving employment-related daycare, we as a state really don't know about you.
I understand. That's good.
Looking at sort of data from across the country, and we're actually fortunate to have Roberta Bobby Weber at OSU in the state, who's really like the national expert on this, and she did a lovely presentation on these issues to House Early Childhood Family Support recently. But what she and other researchers have been finding across the country, there seems to be somewhat of a decline in license-exempt child care and an increase in licensed child care, and that seems to be happening across the country. So this isn't really fully what are the drivers. There's some things that are happening with new CCDF rules that'll probably augment that, and I'll touch on those. But that dynamic, and actually, let me skip ahead just for 1 second to a slide. This is out-of-date information. This is from the Oregon Population Survey, which gives you a little bit of sense of when this data is from. But this gives you a sense of where children are in the state under the age of five. And the reason that I'm still using Oregon Population Survey, there's no way to know what percentage of children are in formal care without actually calling up parents and asking them. So when we had the Oregon Population Survey, we were able to produce this data. So my guess is that 30% probably declined a little bit. The 27% increased. Fluctuations in the economy have affect that 43%. One thing that I think that's always worth calling out when you look at this chart, when you think about that 30%, you know, I sometimes say we have a child care system in this country. It's called grandma. Yeah. Grandmas are really a crucial part of this system, of that 30%.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry. I don't know if that sort of helps.
No, thank you. Your, thank you.
Now I need to.
All right.
I'll be quiet.
Were there any other questions on the child care slide? I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview of our staffing by fund type, because I think this is also really important in sort of helping understand the size of the organization. You know, as I discussed earlier, most of our staffing is in the Office of Child Care, and that's federally funded. So you see from this slide, it's really about a quarter of our staffing that's general fund funded, and the majority, by significant margin, is really federally funded through CCDF. And this is just, you know, the formal organizational chart looking at that same set of information. A number of questions have come up about our particular programs, and so I'd like to spend a little bit of time walking you through the program and grant side part of our budget and what that actually means. So of our current service level budget, $384 million is grants and programs, the money that goes directly out to communities to serve children and families. And as I mentioned, you know, about $100 million of that also includes those funds that we send over to DHS for employment-related daycare. I'm going to start the program side with our early learning hubs, which in some sense are really a key link and bridge between the state and communities with which we work. In 2013, the legislature passed the authorizing statute for the early learning hubs, and in statute required there to be no more than 16 hubs and to have those 16 hubs covering the entire state. This will be the first contract budget cycle in which all of the early learning hubs have been up and running from the beginning of the biennium. I think it's also important to note that while some of this 19.6 goes to the hubs for their operational needs, really most of this funds is intended for them to invest in their community with community partners and community programs, sort of based on identifying those focus population and needs to make those community investments.
Okay. And is there any data on kind of how much is kept at each of the hubs and how much goes out? Because I know the premise of the hubs is not for the hubs to be service providers, right, but for the hubs to be funnels, that it comes in and goes out through their communities.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Senator Murrow, committee members, yes, I can give you some of that. And in fact, we've, in some sense, it's sort of formally built into the structure of the funding. So when the Early Learning Council helped us with the funding to the hubs after last legislative cycle, it got broken down into sort of three buckets in which we asked them to spend it: hub coordination funds, funds around that goal of children arriving at kindergarten ready to succeed, and children living in healthy and stable attached families. And really, particularly for those second two in particular, it's really seen as community investments. But I can get you those numbers.
Thank you.
So what is an early learning hub? Hubs are really designed to be that to support the underserved children and families in their region to learn and thrive by making resources and supports more available, to identify those underserved children in their community, evaluate the needs of those populations, and then to work to ensure that those programs and services are there and that those families are connecting to them. So the goal is for the hubs not to be the direct providers of services to children and families. There are some places where hubs play a somewhat more direct role in sort of some of that collaboration coordination function. But I think, you know, one of the ways that we think of the early learning hubs is the state partners in building a true early learning system that works for families. And, you know, while I think there's an important body of work that has to happen at the state level to make those connections happen, I think the reality is that state work doesn't really mean anything if it's not working in communities where the children and families actually live. But this also means that a lot of the hub work is really focused on building those bridges and those connections between those other systems in the community. So working directly with local schools and school districts and superintendents, with health, with the local human services. We've seen some really great collaborations with CCOs. And then they're also tasked with bringing the business sector into the that conversation. To be honest, that's a place I think they found a little bit more challenging. But this just gives you a map of what that early learning hub system looks like at the moment. I already touched on...
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just wanted to go back one quick slide. I know that when we were here 2 years ago and even last year, there were still some gaps in the early learning hub. Some got up more quickly than others. So I just wanted to confirm that all of these hubs are up and fully functioning.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe, all of these hubs have been up and running since before the start of this biennium. Some of them were up and running just a little bit before the start of the biennium, but they have all been up and running in this formation, this biennium. So I think this is really, you know, we're at the stage where learning more and getting a better sense of how that work is working and how to strengthen and improve it as well.
And then one other small question, then I'll get to you, Senator Roblin. So one of them has incorporated at the end of its name. What's that about?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe committee members. So one of the features of the early learning hub system is that the state did not prescribe the backbone entity in which they would be embedded. And so what you see is really a wide variety of the organizational structure. So we have quite a few hubs, about seven, where an ESD is the backbone organization. YAMHEL, Early Learning Hub, the CCO is the backbone organization. We have some where county governments are involved, some where community colleges are involved.
I believe Multnomah County
is. And a couple where it's United Ways. The one where you see Inc., I believe, that's Marion Polk Early Learning Hub, Inc., they incorporated as a standalone nonprofit. So I think that is the origin of the Inc.
Okay.
But what I do like to say is I'm not sure that there's a sort of a right or wrong answer to what that backbone organization, but I think having those variety of backbone organizations has helped in a number of communities, I wouldn't say universally always, for it to be sort of the hub to be more community-owned than sort of saying this is embedded in this layer of government.
Well, I would argue that that has generally been our premise, is instead of imposing from the state, let's let each community figure out what works best for them. So I would argue that that's a good reflection of that. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, my only concern, in my district, we have one of those really large ones. So you go from Reedsport on the coast to, I think it's Lakeview, in that sense, how is that going? Because they had a lot of concerns in getting up and going, and I have been concerned. I haven't watched it as closely. Some of the other ones, their geography makes more sense. That's
Chair Smith Warner and Senator Roblin. Without talking in particular about individual,
I know, I understand.
I would say that there are. I would say for the most part, the territories are seeming to make sense.
Okay.
I would not say in 100%. I would not say in 100% of the situations I would say there are some territories where the geography is a challenge that communities are trying to work through.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few that you can't get from one part to the other without going through a few others.
And what some of communities have done has
never
also sort of
maintained
at the same time that there's a sort of basic hub regional governance. They've also created in some of those bigger, particularly rural hubs, county level community discussions as a way of trying to balance that. But I will be honest, I think for some of the larger, more rural hubs with huge amounts of territory, but also relatively sparse population.
Those are
challenges, and those are also challenges I think we find trying, you know, in in coverage in general.
I mean, one of the issues is we made an issue that there would only be 16, right? So if you got together early and figured your space, you could connect it. If you decided to be late, there might not be any more places except one. And I think we have to look at that at some point and say, we picked an arbitrary number called 16. Is that the right thing to do? And I just bring it up because there's one in my district. I have 1, 2, 3, 4 of them, 5, 6. I have 6 of those hubs in my district. So.
Jeez. Kutcher, Smith, Warner, Monroe, Senator Roblin, I think you're correct about. So the goal was to allow communities to be self-forming, but the reality is when you say self-forming and 16, it did mean that there needed to be communities that had to be nudged together to create a complete map.
Representative Lively,
thank you, Co-Chair, and I just wanted to for the committee's information. We have a new committee in the House this time called Early Childhood and Family Supports. And so a lot of these questions you're asking, we're asking. In fact, we just reviewed with the hubs and that, and we asked the question about is 16 the right number or not. So we're reviewing a lot of those, working with the division and department to try to take the forward look whether this is the actual structure. And so hopefully by the time of the end of this session, when the committee's had the whole session to operate, we'll have more recommendations and things. But we are asking those questions in that and working with the division to try to see where it's at, and it, specifically with childcare, I can tell you it's a big priority for the committee about how do we work collaboratively to make sure more children have access to affordable and high-quality childcare.
Okay, thank you. Okay, go ahead.
So I already spent a lot of time talking to you about the operational sides of the Office of Childcare. There's also a series of grants and programs that go out through the Office of Child Care. Again, the biggest part of this number are the funds for direct subsidies for low-income families receiving child care. It's about $107 million of that. Most of that is employment-related daycare. There's a few smaller pots of special population subsidies, like the teen parent program, where we fund some child care facilities directly in high schools to allow teen parents to be able to continue with their high school education. There are also another number of other important services that we grant out, particularly to support the workforce, those 22,000 providers that are really the heart and the soul of this work, who work with directly with children and families. Most important of those is our child care network of child care resource and referral agencies.
Excuse me for just a second, David. Representative Wisnett, and then Senator.
I'm just going to be. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a positive. I went, attended the 211 information thing. I think that's very effective. And you're going to talk about expanding that to statewide or something. Some more funding, contracting, good. So I think that's a good way to go. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, David. ERDC seems to be so critical. What are their parameters for employment-related daycare? How, you know, what are the income limitations on it? And are we serving all people that fall within those parameters, or most, or some percentage of, or whatever? It strikes me that employment-related daycare is one of the most important statewide programs that we have.
Co co-chair Smith Warner and Monroe committee members. Yes, no, it's really a crucial program. With the funding available, we're currently serving, and this is sort of it's a complicated estimate for a number of reasons, about 17% of the eligible population.
1 in 6.
17%.
Yeah.
There is a work requirement that goes along with that. We've made it a little bit more flexible for education around that. The current income eligibility is for entering into the program is 185% of a federal poverty limit. Last session, the exit eligibility was increased to 250% to reduce the cliff. There's also a copay that goes along with it. So it's a complicated formula. And to be honest, it would be probably better to have someone from the Department of Human Services walk you through the copay formula. But based on number of hours and income, there is a part that the parent pays directly to the provider.
Yeah.
That increases with income. So it does get to be some parents, particularly when you're getting close to the 185 or 250, are picking up a significant part of that tab, and it never fully covers it.
Senator Revlin.
So does DHS get federal match for the money that we send in from ours in this program, or is it fully funded by us and the portion that the parents pay?
Co-chair Smith Warner and Monroe. So the CCDF is the major source of the federal dollars are the major source of funding for employment-related daycare. In 2015, prior to 2015, there was a little bit of general fund in CCDF and not so much. It's varied over the decades. Last legislative session, there was a fairly significant general fund investment in employment-related daycare, but the majority of the funds for employment-related daycare still remain federal.
Okay.
There are very complicated match and maintenance of effort, but that's never been a challenge for us. So, for instance, our state investment in I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, so don't quote me. So our state investment in OPK, I think, counts towards there's multiple forms of the match to make it even messier. But some of our other early learning investments count towards the match, as would our general fund investment employment-related daycare. But that's something that we've always done a good job. I've never really, you know, as far as the history I know, has never been at issue at the moment.
Follow up.
Yes.
So have we maxed the amount we could get from the federal government for this program? Mm-hmm. Or if we had more of an investment, would we get more?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe, Senator Roblin, we draw down everything we can draw down.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
So I just did want to mention the Child Care Resource and Referrals Network that's really responsible for those community-based trainings, providing the coaching and supports directly to providers. And one of the things I did want to call out is part of their charge is also to look at the supply of child care in a community. So they are also tasked with addressing Representative Wisnett's concern about that. I wouldn't say that they by any means have the resources to address that on their own. As Representative Wisnett also mentioned, beginning this biennium, we moved some of that referral function for parents from the Child Care Resource and Referral to the statewide 211 info, and that now is fully statewide. One of the things that we continually hear from parents is they want one number to call for information, and one of the great things that that the 211 is allowing is that because there's a couple things it allows. One is that there are a number of different state agencies that are now putting money into 211, so I think that's adding up to something really important. But it also means that when a parent calls up and asks for a child care referral, they're able to ask a couple other questions and find out, is this a parent that could be accessing WIC that isn't, or needs to access energy assistance funds. So I think it's really a great both nonprofit and state collaboration to better meet the needs of children and families. I think that's what systems building, when we talk about it, really is about. Okay. We talked about this a little, so I'll move over this. I keep on talking about the Child Care Development Fund, and I can talk a little bit more about it. You've already heard me mention this multiple times. From the funding, staffing, and program slides I shared with you earlier, it should already be pretty clear the state, we couldn't be doing much of what we're doing without this fund. The story's getting a little bit more complicated. In 2014, Congress reauthorized the Child Care Development Fund for the first time in almost 20 years. As part of that reauthorization, they made clear that CCDF has two main goals. Helping families access and afford safe child care so they can work, and promoting positive child development by strengthening the quality of early learning experiences, particularly those in child care. They also did something else. Along with the reauthorization came a number of new requirements and responsibilities for the state, but not new additional funding to pay for them.
Shocking.
And I want to go over with you some of the most significant part of these new requirements. So we've always been responsible for doing annual health and safety monitoring for child care facilities and family child care homes that are licensed. There's a new requirement that if you are license exempt but receiving child care subsidies attached to CCDF dollars, you also need to be receiving an annual on-site health and safety monitoring. Mm-hmm. So what House Bill 2015 in the 2015 session did, knowing this was coming down the road, was gave the Office of Child Care the authority to do those on-site health and safety monitorings. And again, this is, I think, a model of our collaboration with DHS. So even though DHS really runs that program, since we already have that monitoring shop, it made sense for the Office of Child Care to take on that new responsibility. But, you know, any one time there's a couple thousand license-exempt providers on employment-related daycare, and there's also a lot of churn in that population. So you're really talking about potentially a couple thousand on-site, in-person health and safety monitoring visits a year that we're now taking on in addition to, you know, the 5,000 licensed child care facilities.
Senator Roblin?
So those are those sites that have three or less kids?
There's a Co-Chair Smith and Warner, Monroe, Senator Roblin. For the most part, yes. There's a couple other statutorily identified license-exempt child care pieces. So if you are a public entity and you run a child care facility, you are also license exempt.
Oh, okay.
So if this august body decided to run a child care facility, we would have no authority to license you. And then there's also a class of license exempt preschool. So if you're serving 3 and 4 year olds for fewer than 5 hours per day and have an educational focus, you're also license exempt.
So follow up, yeah. So that means, like, if a university has a daycare facility within it, if a high school has a daycare facility within it, those are new ones that you may have to do this. You
if
would have done some
subsidy.
Of that. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, how about faith churches? And if they provide daycare, do you inspect them or are they exempt?
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, Senator, Representative Wisnett. A significant portion of those license-exempt preschools, and I couldn't give you an exact figure, are faith-based organizations. So they would not be license-exempt based simply on being faith-based, but a large percentage of the faith-based are those part-day preschool programs.
Just a follow-up comment. Mm-hmm. I think they provide a significant number, though, that we need them. And thank you.
So along with the new on-site health and safety monitoring, there are also a brand new set of federal requirements. So basically, these are things that we need to be doing in order to still continue in receiving that about $140 million per biennium around fingerprints and background checks. So right now, so now everyone who's licensed and also licensed again providers, but this sort of more of a DHS issue, will be required to go through what's called the full FBI fingerprint background check. We only used to do that for providers who had lived out of state in the last couple of years. So it was a very small percentage of providers. We're now going to be required to do that for everyone in the central background registry. So when we did sort of a time check, it used to be for our staff, it would take about 10 minutes to do that fingerprint, that background check. With the full FBI fingerprint background check, that moves from 10 minutes to 40 minutes. So you multiply that change by 28,000 per year. It really is a really huge staffing commitment.
Senator Roblin?
You said per year, so they have to get a background check every year?
Smith, Coacher Smith Warner and Monroe, Senator Roblin, no, they do not do it every year. We do 28,000 per year.
Wow. Okay.
But there is a cycle for that, and we're going to work on adjusting that cycle because we're now in the situation where the state requirements and the federal requirements don't match. So we are actually in the process, as Representative Lively will hear soon, learn more about in the committee he chairs, trying to bring those into alignment.
That one's more expensive. Does the person have to pay for it themselves?
Commissioner Smith Warner, Monroe, Senator Roblin, this is a really good and important question, and that I will also be coming back to. Yes. So there's both a real cost to the division in the processing of this, some of that just purely in terms of staff time. There is also a cost. For the fingerprint capture, it previously was about $3, if I'm remembering correctly. It will be going up to about $90.
It's electronically.
For a small family child care provider, this is a real issue, because this applies not just to the provider; it also applies to other adults in the household who may have unsupervised access to children. So one of the things that you will see, this has already started to go into effect, and because. Going back to what you were saying about, do we draw down all our CCDF? Yes, we do. For some reason, a few states don't. So we got a little bit of extra money in the fall, and we are currently using that to subsidize the new cost to about $45. But we probably can do that through.
So we should expect to hear more about this.
Yeah. But it does mean that there's about $2.9 million in other funds request that we have in our budget to be able to collect those new fees.
Okay.
And then just the other part of these new requirements is some new requirements about providing information, particularly around complaints and compliance to families that we're working on. But the bottom line on this, and this is something I will come back to the end, is part of our budget does have a $6.1 million fund shift of funds that we would normally be sending over to DHS for employment-related daycare that we need to hold on to in order to do this work and keep getting the rest of the funds. And now we shift away from CCDF. So we already talked about this a little bit, but our largest part of our general fund and our grant and aid is for current service level, $153 million to Oregon pre-kindergarten. As I mentioned earlier, this is really a close collaboration with the federal Head Start program. When OPK was created, I believe it's back in 1988, we basically wrote into state statute that whatever the federal Head Start performance standards are, those are the standards for OPK. that really has the nice advantage of at the program classroom level, where programs are able to really work pretty seamlessly with those two funding streams. What I forgot to also mention, so both OBK and Head Start serve 3- and 4-year-olds living in poverty, offer preschool programming, but also really have a great emphasis on family engagement and connecting children and families to other comprehensive services. Real focus on screening, vision screening, developmental screening, and also working with parents. Home visits are part of that model. All but 7 of our 28 programs receive both federal and state funding. So we have 7 standalone OPK programs. The flip side of that seamless adopting into state statute, the Head Start performance standards, also means that when the federal Head Start performance standards change, so do our program standards change. And one of the things that's coming down the pike is the federal program is in the process of trying to transition that of Head Start from being a part-day program to a full-day program. The exact nature and timing of what that will look like is sort of a little bit of a wait and see. They've called for the federal goal has been to convert all programs to full day by 2021. They've also said that's partially contingent on what state funding means, but it does mean that, and 15 of our programs have gotten some federal, what they're calling duration extension grants, to at least for some of their children in classrooms to be able to extend the part-day programs to full day. But there's sort of 2 issues that we're going to need to be working through, and have really been starting to have this conversation with the Head Start Association and our OPK providers of, you know, a classroom can't function if it's having some funding in one classroom for part day and full day. So we may have to be doing some conversion of some of the OPK slots to full day over the next biennium as this rolls out. So I do want to put this on the table because it may mean that if, for instance, our current budget, our budget for the next biennium ends up being the current service level, we could be coming back to you in 2 years and saying, and yes, we actually are serving with those funds somewhat fewer children than we had been serving in the past biennium. So I'd like to also spend a little time talking to you about our newest program. This is Preschool Promise. The authorizing legislation for this was in 2015, and it just really rolled out in the fall of last year. So we're really still in the learning stages of this, but it's just been a really exciting opportunity. We now have 13 children across 9 hubs who are now participating in Preschool Promise in 93 sites. So these are the directions that you as the legislature gave us around Preschool Promise, serving children up to 200% federal poverty line, early learning hubs in identifying focus population and providers best able to serve those populations, instructional hours equivalent to full-day kindergarten, lead teachers with bachelor's degree, and also tasked the Early Learning Council with setting minimum target salaries for lead teachers. So for me, this is really the
Senator Roblin.
So that those a couple of those have created problems for our Head Start, because all of a sudden all their qualified teachers are looking to get the higher salary, so they leave, and it leaves us in a lurch with respect to our other deals. I'll look over at Representative Lively since he's working on it. Thank you.
For me, this is really the most exciting part about what Preschool Promise has really made possible. We talk about mixed delivery, but what that really means is an opportunity to communities through the hubs to identify early learning providers in the community that work most closely with children that community has identified as needing and wanting to reach, and really expanding the kinds of opportunities to meet family needs. And I'm really excited to see the broad mix of programs that the hubs were able to bring together for this first year of Preschool Promise. We have about 16% of our Preschool Promise programs are OPK or Head Start programs, so they're also really an important part of this mix. We have 20% that are in child care, another 24% also including family child care, 24% in public schools, and 11% in preschools that are being run by community-based organizations. And so I also think that in many ways this is a real systems building initiative, because there's nothing like having schools and childcare and Head Start running the same kind of program to figure out where the connections are happening and not happening. I think we've learned a lot this fall about some of the places where there need to be better connections and stronger integration. But I think that's what – I don't think we would have learned that without this model actually being on the ground in communities to drive some of those conversations and unearth some of those challenges. Also,
just
wanted to check with the committee on timing and where you would want me
to. Yeah, I was just going to say, actually, perhaps we could have a little conversation about, do you want to talk about this map for a second? Because I think we should stop at the end of Preschool Promise and get any of the rest of our questions out, and then we'll move on to Healthy Families on Monday.
Yeah, and this is just to give you a map of the rollout of Preschool Promise. What the council did was have a competitive RFP process for this first year of rollout. Some hubs decided that they had enough on their plate and decided not to participate. And so that's part of the story of how we ended up with this map.
And I will say briefly that I was able to go to a place out in David Douglas where it's a mix. There's a whole variety. There's Preschool Promise, there's OPK, there's Head Start. And I was able to visit two culturally specific Head Start classrooms, one for Burmese kids and one for Somali kids. And it was a great experience. It really was such an exposure of exactly the kinds of things we need to do, you know, with these immigrant populations that will integrate those kids and their families into the system early. And I think it was really important. Senator Thompson.
Well, thank you, Kutcher. Are they going to continue the Preschool Promise program? Do you know? Is this going to be, because was last year the first year they did this?
Co-chairs Warner Monroe, Senator Thompson. The Preschool Promise is in our current service level. So our plan based on that would be to continue with the hubs that we're currently working with on Preschool Promise and not to expand it based on that current service level.
Okay.
But again, that's ultimately a legislative decision.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, are the hubs allowed to go across the line to do work and things? Because I think Representative Lively and Director are aware that we're if you look at the geography of Klamath County, there's a real division once you go over the mountain, but there's the northern part is more relationship spinning and everything with Deschutes. So what happened on a case like this is you authorized Klamath County to do something which we thought people in Deschutes County could do more efficient and effective, but they were not involved during the decision or say, we can provide that service for you. I think you know about the situation a little bit. So was that an issue that they can't go outside the boundary is my question. And how do we be sure that we're getting the best bucks for the dollar to do the services?
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Monroe, Representative Wisnett. So under the, I believe this is the correct interpretation of the authorizing statute, is they really do have the authority only to support services within their hub region.
Do we need to follow up? Should we reconsider that and look at what's the most effective use of our funds?
That might be a good conversation to have with Representative Lively in the in that newly formed committee.
He's adequately working on it.
Thank you. You just keep adding to it.
Okay, any other questions for today? Okay. Thank you both for being here. And with that, I will close both hearings. Both for being here. And with that, I will close both.